CoOptimus.com presents the CoOptiCast.
And welcome back to another CoOptiCast. This is CoOptiCast episode number 20 for Sunday, May 31st, 2009. And we are on the precipice of E3 2009. So before we get going into the news from there, or soon-to-be news from there, let's talk about what we've been playing. And we're actually joined tonight. It's a threesome tonight.
We start by putting our foot in our mouth.
Kat's joining us. Kat, how are you doing?
I am good.
Good. And Mike is joining us from the hospital bed. He is he's having brain scans done as we speak. He's actually in the CT scanner, aren't you?
Yeah, let's go with that.
Okay. Great. So, Mike, what have you been playing?
Well, with the exception of the past few days where I've felt like crap, it all started with our co-op night last Tuesday. Jason and I have rediscovered our complete and beautiful love for Dawn of War 2, so we've been rolling through the entire campaign again, just having an absolute blast. I'm going to go ahead and say that's probably going to be my game of the year this year. Nothing else I've played has come close to how much fun that is, so yay. I've been making myself motion sick and infamous because, yeah, that game has some frame rate issues. Played a little bit of Killing Floor, gonna play a little more of that later, but that's a really interesting Red Orchestra meets Left 4 Dead clone. So, I think you've been playing that too, Nick.
Yeah, I've played a few rounds of it, been enjoying it.
Yeah, so it's really cool. I finally beat Wolverine, which has got the lamest ending of a game I've played in a while, but I had a blast all the way there. Still playing some Broken Sword on the DS, and thanks to Jason, I have been playing Final Fantasy Adventure for the Game Boy, which is one of my favorite old classic Game Boy games that I had lost my copy of. And now I'm reliving the awesome quest against Dark Lord.
I don't think I've ever played that. Is that like original Game Boy? Like
original Game Boy. It is. The Secret of Mana was the sequel to it.
Interesting.
Yes.
Very cool. How about you, Kat? What have you been playing?
I guess mostly recently. I've been playing a whole lot of Halo Wars. Just completely addicted to it. Especially with the new DLC. It's been a lot of fun to just explore all of the options there. Let's see, I also picked up Wolverine and have been playing that quite a bit. The boss battles are quite irritating, but the rest of it is satisfyingly brutal in every way. let's see, and I also got the more recent Phoenix Wright game, so I'm playing the third one of that. And Band of Bugs.
Best final case ever.
Well, the ends of those games have been really neat so far. Actually, the whole thing has been awesome with Phoenix Wright. They're very addicting. And Band of Bugs, I've been playing kind of missions here and there. Yeah, that's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, like you, I've been playing some Halo Wars and just checked out the DLC as well. And I was surprised about how fun that is. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later. I've also been playing some Infamous. And it's Crackdown with electricity, basically. But not quite as good. Killing Floor, which we talked about, Dawn of War 2 for a co-op night. Started playing through that on the Patriarch difficulty, which is it's a lot of fun, but it's kind of frustrating because you sit in cover for a long time. So
takes forever to gun everybody down.
Yeah, it really takes a long time to complete the missions in it, but it's still really satisfying. And finally, Raiden Fighters Aces. I'm just loving to being able to pick that up and play through a couple of rounds, trying to get a high score and stuff. Best $20 I spent in a long time, so I'm pretty happy with that.
You know, if going back to Infamous, if they crossed that with Mass Effect, it would be like the ultimate Emperor RPG, like Star Wars Emperor Palpatine.
Yeah.
You know, you're just lightening the crap out of everybody.
I do get the Star Wars Force Unleashed feel when I'm using the lightning thing in it.
Yeah.
But Anyway, let's move on. We got a jam-packed episode here. There's been plenty of news, and we're going to go through some of this stuff from the past week or so here. There's a new trailer for Marvel Ultimate Alliance 2 that got released, and in the trailer, some new characters were shown. Green Goblin, we saw Venom, She-Hulk, Cable, and Juggernaut. And what Kat actually found out is Juggernaut is a GameStop exclusive character. How lame is that?
Super
About as
duper
lame as
lame.
Juggernaut, really.
What's
I said
that?
about as lame as Juggernaut.
Oh, that's not nice. Actually, with the Juggernaut GameStop exclusive, we should get a couple of those codes to hand out on the site. So if you guys are extra nice, we might hand out a couple of them to you.
There we go. See, it's not exclusive to GameStop. We have it too. Yeah, GameStop and Activision have really been in bed lately with their exclusive codes and stuff. Like Wolverine had an exclusive arena that you could only get at GameStop. I think I saw something with Guitar Hero 5 and some exclusive tracks. Now we have this with Marvel Ultimate Alliance. I don't know. What do you guys think about this? The retailer exclusive stuff. We've seen a lot of times where it's retailer exclusive, like special editions. They'll only have the soundtrack or they only have this figure or whatever. But actual game content, like the game character, is kind of a huge thing. It's not. It's. I don't know because
Well,
the character is obviously going to be in the game, right? So the content's going to be there for everybody, but just the cool GameStop people can play it.
I don't mind inconsequential stuff like I think Prince of Persia had character skins and certain other things that were a little different. But when it gets into things like gameplay modes or things that are of consequence, I get really irritated. And Activision, like you said, is notoriously bad at this. And I just want to say that if someone is going to make a retailer exclusive bit of content, that's really not going to drive me to a particular retailer if I don't want to shop there. Like GameStop, you can get all the exclusives you want, but that doesn't mean I'm going to give you my money.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on. Stupid GameStop. There is a new trailer was unveiled, I think Wednesday, for a new Warhammer 40K game called Space Marine. It's from Relic, and the looks of it is it's kind of like 2Human meets Warhammer 40K. It's a action RPG where you control a space marine. Surprise.
Shock.
I know, shocking. The game actually, there was a trailer leaked about, I think it was like 6 months or so ago, of a game of the same name. And it actually is the same game, but it was from a different developer. And that developer closed down, and Relic kind of assimilated it. And from what we hear, it's actually quite a bit different, though, from the original setup.
I'm actually okay with that because Relic has proven twice now that they are the only developer that can really translate Warhammer 40K into anything usable. I don't know if you've played any of the older RTSs, but they're pretty much all garbage.
Yeah.
And
Well, wasn't there like a called like Fire Warrior or something or
yeah,
Fire
that
for
was
the
all. I think that was a console game.
it was an Xbox game or
Yeah.
something, and it was supposed to be atrocious.
Yeah,
Yeah, it was
the
pretty
DS one that
bad.
I recently got is pretty bad. I was surprised how bad it was, actually.
That's like an RTS as well, isn't it? Or a turn-based
It
strategy,
was a
right?
turn-based kind of a strategy. It was just not very playable, and the environments were dreadful.
Interesting.
Well, the Relic's the only ones that's really gotten 40K. I mean, Mythic got Warhammer Online really nailed, but that's the fantasy version. So we've finally gotten a good fantasy game, and with Dawn of War and Dawn of War 2, we've finally gotten good 40K games. So I trust that Space Marine will actually, despite Relic being primarily a PC developer, they did put out the outfit a while back, so it's not
Yeah.
like they're stranger to console games.
Yeah,
So
the outfit
I'm
was pretty
hoping that
fun.
they'll bring the same panache that they brought to Dawn of War 2 to Space Marine, and
Yes.
maybe it'll be a little bit more playable than 2Human, but
We'll see.
we'll
So
see.
there's no confirmed co-op in it yet, but the trailer shows a lot of like kind of squad-based cutscene kind of a things where it's a space marine with other space marines, so we're keeping our fingers crossed that we see some co-op in that.
Well, considering Relic put co-op into Dawn of War 2, I don't see why they wouldn't. It's already proven that they know how to make good co-op.
Yeah, the outfit had co-op as well, and that was actually pretty fun in that, so.
Yeah.
Moving on, we have a interesting announcement from the developers of The Conduit, which is a first-person shooter for the Wii, which comes out next month, which is tomorrow, next month. But the game is called The Grinder, and it is a four-player co-op vampire and werewolf hunting game. It's kind of like Left 4 Dead for the Wii, but you waggle to kill things. I don't know. I really don't know how it works, but... It's an interesting fit for the system because it's kind of out of place. I don't know. Did you guys see anything on this? What are your thoughts?
I'm going to withhold my thoughts until people actually start determining whether The Conduit is any good or not, because there's a lot of pressure put on The Conduit to be the game that cracks open first-person shooters on the Wii. And to me, it kind of looks painfully generic. So, I want to hear some actual opinions of people who have played it, and not just, you know, developer previews. And, you know, Left 4 Dead is great, the concept's great, if anyone can pull it off, it appears to be these guys, but I'm just not sure.
Yeah, with their backing in Hunter the Reckoning, it should be interesting to see how they translate it to the Wii. I mean, with the Wii's unique, you know, shooting abilities, I mean, you get attachments for pretty much every game. It should be neat to see how that works exactly. So I look forward to it either way.
Is it supposed to be like an on rails kind of a shooter?
I don't think so. Like the way the developer had it on their website, it didn't look like an on rails shooter at all. So it seemed pretty free roaming anyway, and I think it'll be kind of neat to see what they do with it.
Interesting. Okay. Moving on. At first DLC pack for Halo Wars was released. It's called Strategic Options, and it was 800 Microsoft points. And what it adds is three gameplay modes: tug of war, keep away, and
reinforcements.
Yeah. Thank you. And like we said earlier in the show, both Kat and I have been playing a ton of this. I've been pleasantly surprised with it. At first I was kind of like, well, I'll get it so we can cover for the site and stuff, but I've really been having a lot of fun with it, especially the keep away mode.
Yeah, the capture the flag is definitely the best out of all of them. It's not really a capture the flag, it is more of a keep away, but that's what they call it.
It's oddball. Why didn't they call it oddball? Yeah. Seriously.
Well, because you don't rack up time points. As soon as your character that's holding the ball dies, you lose all of that credit. So it's not quite the same as oddball either. I mean, it's kind of a toss-up. I think keep away is the best way to describe it.
Yeah. Yeah, so what happens is a little sentinel spawns, and you have to go capture it, and then you have to hold it for 2 minutes without that unit dying. And if you do hold it for that 2 minutes, then you score a point. In the co-op, I think it was 4 points to win the map.
Yeah. At least with the two-player. I'm not sure if it would be even more with three-player.
Yeah. So basically, these are skirmish modes. And it really worked well with co-op because, like, we would focus on specific units. Like, you would be building the ground units and stuff, and I'd work on the air units to work on capturing the flag, and then just, like, hovering over a canyon or something to try and cheat our way out of it, right?
Yeah, that was pretty much it.
But it was tough. We did it on Legendary because we're achievement whores. We wanted the achievement. And it was pretty tough. So,
yeah, you can definitely tell the difference in the modes. It's interesting.
The reinforcements one is kind of a unique take on an RTS as well, because what you have is a timer that counts down and basically, the computer gives you a set number of units based on how many resources you have. You don't get to choose what units you get. So it's a race to build as many resource structures as you can. And what it does is, like, you have to decide when to attack or to defend, because if you attack and you run out of units, you're completely defenseless because you have to wait for the next reinforcements wave to come.
Right.
So that was kind of interesting. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that in an RTS game.
Yeah, it was really different and kind of fun to play, just because of how different it was. I mean, I had been playing skirmishes that entire week, and as fun as the skirmishes are, it's kind of neat to have a completely different take on it. So, yeah.
And finally, the tug of war mode, we neither of us could really figure out what counts as what. But there's a little happy face and a frowny face in the top left, and a little meter, and it goes back and forth depending on how well you're doing. But we couldn't figure out what exactly contributed to it, because we could just be building stuff and it would go up.
Yeah. So. I'm not sure if it's a combined thing, like the supplies that you have mined and the units produced at the same time, or the amount of buildings or fortresses you own, or I don't know. I looked everywhere and I couldn't find a definitive definition for this one.
That's probably the only downside, I thought, to the DLC, was there was no, like, here's the modes, here's where they are, here's the goals. Like, there's no help, unless we just, like, completely missed it.
Right. Well, I looked at the goals, and it just says to keep the cursor on the bar closer to your end of the gauge, basically, and that's how you win, and that's all it said. It didn't really say what contributes to it or anything like that. So, that was kind of weird.
All right, well, let's move on. Just got a couple quick stories we wanted to touch on. Mike and I, we had talked about Battleforge a few episodes back, and now it's free. Damn it, I paid money for it. Now it's free.
Well, it's it's free to play in that you get kind of a basic package and can go in, but you still have to buy the cards, and you don't.
Right.
And as far as I understand, you don't get the free points to buy cards like you did when you bought the retail package. So it's still. You know, your retail purchase is still a little, it still holds value over the free version, but this is probably how the game needed to be introduced in the first place.
It should have been how it was in the first place, but.
But it's, you know, it's a very solid co-op game. You know, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, worth checking out for sure. The Zune HD was announced with Xbox Live integration. And we don't know what the details of it are yet, but we will find out tomorrow, which would be yesterday by the time you listen to this. So you already know what the details are.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I like the idea if I can, like, check my friends list on my my Zune and, like, say, hey, want to co-op? Like, that'd be cool.
The only thing I'll have to say about the Zune HD now is that it appears to be aimed squarely at the people that would buy an iPod Touch.
Yeah.
And to me, the only way that Microsoft is going to get inroads on that crowd is if they offer it at a more competitive price point than the iPod Touch. And the fact that this is really high-end looking with an OLED screen is not screaming to me that that's what they're doing with it. So I really hope they do something extraordinary with the software.
Yeah, like putting your arcade games on there. That would be so neat. I don't know, I'd buy one then, even. And I'm
but
not a techie.
It doesn't have any buttons.
So? I don't know.
What I think is probably going to happen, I mean, Microsoft, they're the master at putting out development tools. Like, their development tools are second to none for this stuff. So if they do create their own thing, it becomes an extension of the XNA toolkit or whatever, which already has Zune capabilities in it for the existing Zune. So if they, you know, add the more stuff to it and kind of come up with an iPod Touch marketplace competitor, it could be interesting, especially if it integrates somehow with Xbox Live. If you can have that cross-platform stuff, like, gives me a geek heart on it. It really does. I really love that kind of stuff. And if I can, like, somehow play a game with someone on the Xbox from a Zune, like, even if it's from a certain aspect of the game, I really like that. That makes me a happy person.
That would be really cool. The problem is, since they've released a device with a different control scheme than current games, there's no, like, everything that comes out for it has to be something that is brand new and developed. Like, you're not going to play Castle Crashers with someone with a Zune HD unless I am completely off the mark about what they're deciding to do with it. So,
wait. What if your 360 controller could sync with it, and you could actually use your 360 controller on the Zune HD?
So you're telling me I need to not only pack this thing in my pocket, but I've also got to make a shoulder sling for a 360 controller?
Oh, a shoulder sling? Come on, it's not that big.
Well, it's certainly not going to fit in, you know, say,
just get
Cat's
a hip
back
holster,
pocket.
It's the same thing.
So just The problem with it is that it's going to need to make some severe inroads for developers to really want to, you know, start integrating it like that. And if it's really expensive, like, I can almost guarantee you this thing will cost more than an arcade SKU for the 360.
Yeah, it probably like, is going to.
What's the point?
Well, what's the iPod Touch is $200 for the 8 gig model, right?
Oh yeah, I'm not saying the iPod Touch is cheap.
Well, no, I'm just trying to think of what they're going to come out at. So they'll probably come out their 16 gig at $229.
I'm going to go ahead and say that this is $249 and $329 for multiple for both versions of this, if there are multiple.
All right, well, let's move on. We talked enough about this.
Okay.
DJ Hero is a game we've been kind of eyeing on, keeping an eye on. The trailer for it was pretty atrocious. Not only was the song, I don't even remember what it was. I think it was like a Pink song or something, or it was bad, but it looked like you were a DJ in a strip club. There were video clips of women dancing on poles. There was like clips of like the characters in the game dancing on stage in like a thong. I was like, what is this? It showed absolutely nothing about the game. So that was pretty disappointing, despite the fact that like some co-op details came out on it that sounded really neat. That there's a specific co-op mode where one player can use the DJ Hero controller to mix songs, while another player can use a Guitar Hero controller to kind of add on to those songs, which sounds pretty interesting.
And here I was thinking you're going to say that there was a stripper pole peripheral and player two had to dance.
Stripper pole hero, I'm a big proponent of that. If we can... I wouldn't put it past Activision to actually make it.
Well, if that indeed comes out, you and I are going to have to perform this at your Christmas party.
Isn't there a Wii game called like Carmen Electra Pole Dancing Exercise?
Yeah,
or something like that?
I'm pretty sure.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Carmen Electra's Pole Dancing Kit.
Yeah, there's a book on that as well, so I wouldn't be surprised if they went towards the exercise group that love the Wii Fit.
That's my kind of exercise. I'm usually sitting. Moving on, Call of Duty Map Pack number 2 is on the way, and it's called Shinomura or something like that. And it's set in the Pacific. There's going to be another co-op zombie map on it, and this time it's the no longer undead zombie or undead Nazis, but undead Japanese soldiers. I don't know what you call them. Actually, I do know what you call them, but I'm not going to say it on this family-friendly podcast.
Wow. all I know is that this map pack might as well be called Buy It for Zombie Mode.
Yeah, well, that's how all of them have been for me. But the big news is that the new map pack will actually have more achievements and trophies, so that should make some people happy.
I would like to see Treyarch take the co-op zombie mode and spin it out as like a $15 arcade title, because I really... still have absolutely no interest in playing Call of Duty World at War, but the zombie mode is apparently really awesome, and everybody I know that has played it really liked it, but I'm not willing to play or purchase that game in order to play this mode, but I would purchase the mode by itself.
Yeah, I predict it's going to be one of those things that a year from now, when Call of Duty World at War is like $15 or $10, a lot of people will pick it up, and a lot of people will be playing just the zombie mode.
Yeah.
So, all right. I think that's about it for our news segment. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking PC versus console co-op gaming. And we'll try and keep it nice. Really, we will.
This is Eric from the Immortal Machines PC Gaming Podcast, where every 2 weeks we discuss retro titles, current releases, and engage in stimulating debates.
Blow it out, Jerry.
Intellectually stimulating. It's about the state of the industry. Come join us anytime at immortalmachines.com and every 2 weeks for our podcast, Immortal Machines. We're all out of gum.
Ready for action.
Musical interlude, commercial break, and everything else. And we're going to talk PC gaming versus console gaming. And like any classic debate, we've got two sides represented today.
Oh boy.
In the blue corner, weighing 474 kilograms. And that counts the CT scanner that he's in.
Oh, okay.
Mike Katsoufrakis.
Hey.
How's he doing, Mike? Are you ready for the big battle?
I'm ready, I think.
And in the green corner, representing the console gaming, weighing 17,000 paperclips, we have Kat. How you doing, Kat?
I'm good.
All right. So now that we got a little lighthearted start there, let's talk about console versus PC co-op gaming. So to start off, I'll kind of set the tone. The PC versus console debate is kind of pretty much beaten to death. And maybe we can touch on it a little bit and talk about the pluses and minuses of both platforms, but it basically boils down to it's purely somebody's opinion.
Pretty much.
Yeah. but there is a... I think there's some distinct differences between the platforms when it comes to co-op gaming. And I think it'd be probably a pretty interesting discussion. So I'll start with you, Mike.
Okay.
What do you think the PC has as like the biggest strength in terms of co-op gaming?
In terms of co-op gaming, well, there's a hardware issue and a console or a game issue, I think. PCs have kind of, because of the piecemeal nature, you have to get a different piece of software for whatever you really want, because until Steam came along, there really wasn't a good central version for anything. But as far as online games go, the PC has so many voice chat options that it makes not the 360 so much, but the Wii and the PS3 look like children's toys in comparison. You know, you got Ventrilo, you've got TeamSpeak, Steam has its own voice chat. Games for Windows Live had its own voice chat, and a lot of games that don't want to depend on any of that also offer voice chat. So, you know, the options for communication are really high, and tied into that is the fact that right now, at least in terms of co-op, the PC's greatest strength is the MMO space. You know, games like Warhammer Online, EverQuest, WoW, even back in the old days with like things like Ultima Online, you know, those games are built from the ground up for co-op on a massive, massive scale. I mean, you had 80-man raids in EverQuest. You had 40, 10, 25, 5-man group-based content in WoW. And all of those are pretty much predicated on your ability to communicate. And, you know, being able to chat with the keyboard is all well and good, but if you're trying to control a game, you know, you're really going to want to be shouting at other people through a microphone, and there is no shortage of methods for doing that, and it's entirely to your preference what you like to use. But I don't know. Like, these days, especially with the elephant in the room being WoW, everyone wants a piece of the MMO pie. So that seems to be where a lot of the co-op focus is going these days.
Yeah. And just to kind of set something with that is, Mike and I have talked about it numerous times on the show. We both think MMOs are, you know, the quintessential co-op game. They're co-op by nature, but it's not something that we cover on the site because it is so broad and it is its own thing, its own giant.
We would cover nothing but patch notes and nuances. Yeah. And frankly, I even though I'm vested in MMOs, I only have a passing interest in hardcore discussion of them, at least with people that are not into them.
Okay. So Kat's representing our console gamers because she's not on best of terms right now with PCs.
Never, actually.
So Kat, what do you think is the strongest feature or thing consoles have for co-op games?
As much as it's kind of bad to say, I think actually casual type online or co-op gaming is a little bit better on the consoles, and not even casual games, but just casually jumping into chats or starting up a game. or something like that. It's a lot more centralized on consoles, so it's a little bit easier to group people up or to figure things out. Though Xbox Live has its own issues with its very infamous trolls that kind of hang out, I guess, on there a lot. So they've both got ups and downs as far as that goes. But what I would actually like to see, personally, is the blend between the two. I've noticed with Final Fantasy XI, they do both console and PC, and you can mix them. So I think it would be kind of neat to see something like that a lot more prevalent in the future.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few...
I was going to say, that's probably... She's right in that that mixed really well, but that's... That game has issues, and we'll leave it there.
Well, yeah, I don't personally play that one, but I'm just saying that idea, the blending idea, is very interesting to me, just because I like PC games. I just have never been able to play them. From a technical standpoint, it's very frustrating. I mean, as you've said, I kind of covet Dawn of War like crazy. I would love to play that game, but it's just not possible.
Well, I think a more apt example of a console and PC game going well together would be Shadowrun.
Yeah.
It lets both, you know, it's a shooter, and it lets people cater to basically what they're more comfortable with. Do you like the mouse and keyboard, or do you like the control pad?
Exactly.
Both have their advantages.
Yeah.
But
I would like to see that with Left 4 Dead as well, and Team Fortress, and pretty much anything like that. It's a matter of preference in most cases, and I think it would be kind of neat to see how they blend together.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of possibility there for some really cool things to happen, because, I mean, the mouse and keyboard is the PC's strength. You have a lot more accuracy, you have a lot more, you know, a lot more buttons to work with and stuff like that. I'd like to see something where the PC has the RTS aspect of it. Like, we were covering a game that's coming out that's both an RTS and a first-person shooter, and you can switch between the viewpoints of it. Like, it's Raven Shield or Raven, or I don't even remember.
I recall a choice quote being uttered about that one.
Yeah, we won't go into anything about the Great Mountain there. It'd be cool if the PC gamers played the RTS piece of that while the console gamers were doing the first person thing and kind of, you know, integrating there in a co-op manner. In games like Battlefield, there's a commander viewpoint, and you know, that commander could be your PC viewpoint, while the first person shooter part could be more geared towards the console. Stuff like that would be pretty interesting. But let's go back to another point Kat just kind of brought up, and we'll touch on that, is probably accessibility of the systems to gamers, and that traditionally consoles are more easily accessible. It's pop a disc in and play.
Well, you're correct to a point, but I would argue that the most played game in the world is Solitaire on Windows. And I don't think anything you could do to argue against that point would convince me that it's anything's more accessible than that.
You got to find it in the start menu, and I know plenty of people that don't know where how to find it. So
okay.
I work the help desk. Trust me, I've actually had calls where people said, I can't find Solitaire. It's because we removed it.
Well, it's because they knew where to look, and it wasn't there, you crafty. Crafty jerk. But yeah, you are right. Like, a casual game is going to be, you know, despite the fact that PopCap got their start doing PC stuff, and it's still where they primarily release things, Xbox Live Arcade and PSN have made it really easy for people to gather in casual games.
Right, and even just casually putting in a disc instead of typing in the key, or in my case, losing the key a couple of times, or installing, or anything like that. I mean, the PlayStation is kind of a monster like that. The install times are ridiculous, but it's not required in a lot of cases, unless you have patches and are connected to the internet. But I don't know, just the whole key thing has always been an issue for me. So,
well, you know, the key thing is kind of irrelevant if you're talking about casual games, because you have things like Kongregate and Yahoo Games, which is all played in the browser.
Right.
You just have to, you go there and you have hundreds of games to play without installing anything or worrying about a disc.
Right. I mean, I'm not even saying casual as in the casual type of game, but just casually playing, just plug and play, basically. I mean, just putting in a disc and turning it on, and you can play with whoever's in the room with you or something like that. Though that option is becoming much more limited, which is kind of disappointing.
So that's probably the other big difference between the two platforms, in that consoles are, at least traditionally, although it's kind of hit or miss nowadays, they're designed for multiple people to be sitting in a room on a couch playing, you know, one system, one disc, four controllers, or whatever. While PCs are, you know, you need some sort of network connectivity, whether it's a LAN party you're at, or, you know, online, or anything like that. So that's probably the other, the biggest difference, I would think, between the two, especially for co-op gamers. To get a session, it's a little bit easier on a console to just get up and running when you have some friends over.
Well, definitely. It's, the console, because it's centered around a TV, which, on its own is a device that's catered towards many people grouping together at once. You know, the consoles were an extension of that, and until recently, when split screens kind of been waning, it was a lot easier. You'd get like four people together and play a lot of games. The Wii is particularly strong at bringing together a group of people to play. The 360 and PS3 are leaning more and more towards being primarily competitive in their multiplayer offerings.
Yeah, for local, yeah.
So, a lot of people want to get together and play Call of Duty 4 and shoot each other to death. Those same people are going to play with groups of people in games like Gears of War. They may be co-oping, but they're on their own system, so it's kind of a crapshoot these days for split-screen support. And even though, personally, that's not my preferred method of play, I'd say almost the majority of people who visit our site really love split screen, so I'm pretty sad to see it go.
God forbid you don't have split screen in your game, our forums light up.
Yeah.
What? No split screen?
It's pretty crazy. The other thing about online that I would bring up is that, the consoles have the ease of use in Xbox Live and PSN, though PSN is not as fun. we'll not even talk about friend codes right now. But the one advantage I would say that a PC gamer does have is if we wanted to play Dawn of War 2 with each other, we'd connect through Games for Windows Live, which is all well and good, and it works really well. But if for some reason Games for Windows Live goes down, you still have the option to try and, set up a LAN. And it takes a little bit of technical know-how, but there are apps out there that let you virtualize a LAN setting and play as if other people were in the same room hooked up as you. So, if I want to play Gears of War online with my buddy and Xbox Live goes down for maintenance or something, I'm screwed, but I may not be due to the nature of a PC game.
Right. Yeah, you have the more options, but we also, from personal experience, me and you have had a hell of a time getting games together.
Yeah, well, review code aside, we did have a bit of an issue with Killing Floor, but that appeared to be a lot of to-do about the servers being slammed. So, and there was a patch released, which is, that's an advantage console games have is, while they are getting almost as bad as PC games and requiring patches these days, the basic functionality usually isn't affected by it. So
I will say, I the one thing, and I've noticed, like, Steam does it really well, is the patches on PCs. Like, I've been playing PC games for 25 years now.
Yeah.
And patches on PCs have always been a pain in the butt. You always had to find a place to download the patch from, and then you had to wait and apply and all this stuff. Now, like, consoles, they automated it, right? You put the game in, it's like, hey, there's a patch, boom, you download it, boom, it restarts, you're in, right? It's like 30 seconds to a minute, not even sometimes, problem solved.
Steam, to a large part, alleviates that.
But... Right, and that's my point. I like that, but more games need to move towards that, where it's just, okay, yeah, there's a patch, take care of it yourself, you know, and I'll play. And the nice thing with Steam is, like, if you have a PC and you keep it on, and a patch comes out, you can download it and apply it. You don't even know it, right? You're in, you have the latest version.
Well, the big thing here is that there are very obvious advantages to a closed system, like a console. You know, there's, you know, it's all pretty, you know, unless you're looking at, like, a refurbished 360 or the 20 versions of the PS3 that exist, it's all basically the same stuff. So, it's going to work well together. Granted, the software support is coded correctly, which is why we have patches. But, you know, things aren't going to break down as much. On a PC, you know, we talk about it being an open platform and that you can, you know, the reason, you know, we can circumvent the centralized stuff is because we have the option to. You know, we can mod games, we can, you know, patch, you know, community members can patch games. But with that goes the fact that everyone's computer is a little different, and not everybody is going to mesh well with everybody else just because of some obscure hardware defect in, you know, the absolute latest driver piece for someone's network card might go down.
Or if someone likes me breathes on your computer or something.
Yeah, or if Cat walks into the room and all of your computers explode. So... Each definitely has its own advantages and disadvantages. Personally, I actually don't have preference, much as some people would like to think I do. I own all the consoles except the Wii, but I had one at one point. But I also keep an up-to-date computer, so I don't really ever fall into the my computer's too outdated to play stuff trap that a lot of people get into. So I might be a little biased.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to add, Kat?
I don't think so. I think that sums it up pretty well in general, so I approve.
See, that wasn't too bad. Nobody get any cuts or bruises, did they?
Nope.
I will say, however, that a mouse-based shooter will... A person that's used to a mouse will school a controller-based person every time.
Okay.
I will go there.
Okay. We won't.
Yeah, I
won't. let's go moving on here. And we're going to skip our review again this week because we really don't have anything of value to bring you from the review perspective. But instead, with E3 starting this week, we had a little bit of another soapbox rant to go on. And maybe talk a little bit about the show and our expectations. And if you read our site Thursday and Friday of last week, you probably saw a crap ton of news. And that's because everyone thought, hey, E3's next week. We don't want to get drowned out by all that noise. Let's release our XYZ announcement today. And so everyone started doing that.
Ugh.
And before you knew it, everyone was drowned out in the pre-release of E3. And it was just, it was ridiculous. There was so much media put out. I must have posted at least a dozen videos of stuff. Screenshots, announcements of games, announcements of features in games, system announcements, system leaks, right? We had the PSP Go leak out over the weekend. It was ridiculous. And I seem to remember 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago technically, that all the publishers were tired of E3 because everyone was fighting for the same noise and they didn't get to do their work. And so they toned it back for 2 years. And so for 2 years, it was a little more low key. It was more private meetings, one-on-ones. You got some more information and stuff, but people weren't generally happy with it. They wanted the glamour and the glitz and stuff. And so they went back to it this year, and in going back to it, now we have the people fighting for the same, you know, vocal prominence.
Well, I think part of the reason that the low-key E3 failed is because outside of the press conferences, when people were going in for the hands-on play, like, when it was the big, everybody flocks to, you know, someone's booth together, and they, you know, they wait in line or whatnot, but there's generally a few different stations to play on for like the bigger stuff. What happened with the low-key one is it became a fight to get private meetings because you wanted desperately to get your private meeting in before, you know, your journalistic competitor got it in so you could break some, you know, hands-on footage or whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, so I went to both the smaller low-key E3s. The first one was in Santa Monica, and it was at a bunch of, it ended up being at a bunch of different hotels. But the meetings were, like you said, one-on-ones or whatever, and maybe people were fighting for space or time or whatever with it, with their coverage. But honestly, it worked really well. I got to play a lot of games, got to talk to developers while I was playing them. It just sucked because we were constantly being shuttled around, and we were wasting time trying to get from place to place and whatever. So they moved it back to the LA Convention Center. But they also changed something else in doing that. They said, well, since we're moving back here, we don't really have, like, literally, like, a lot of the demos for the first E3 I was at was, were in hotel rooms. So it was just, like, you and the developer in a hotel room at the, you know, at a TV or whatever. And it worked really well. So when E3 moved back to the convention center, they kind of had made up these makeshift cubicles in the meeting rooms, and they invited some more people, basically. So what ended up happening was you'd be crammed into this tight little space with like six or seven other journalists and watch a developer play their game and then kind of try and ask questions while that was going on. And it just, it really didn't work last year at all. If they would have kept the same kind of format, same amount of people, and just moved to the convention center, I think people would have been happy.
I don't think that this year's E3 is going to have the same, like the one you mentioned from 2 years ago had a lot of frustrated journalists. You know, you had to travel, you know, to different hotels across town and race, you know, race to make meet appointments and everything. Yeah. But generally the coverage that was coming out was a lot better because they got the time to, you know, not only play the game, but, you know, get the one-on-one questions. They aren't sitting in a pack of people all trying to compete for attention. So that really worked. But the problem was, is, you know, the way E3 is going to work this year is that, you know, with the big show comes a lot of the shotgun blasts of just a ton of information all at once. So you're going to get a lot of PR spin out of this E3 compared to what you would have normally gotten in the past couple of years, because it's all about controlling the message, right? You know, It's why you see games with good reviews only get, like, there'll be a review embargo, but you'll see, you know, oh, X outlet gave it a 9.5 and their review's out, but the rest of us have an embargo until, like, 3 days later. So PR, you know, these days really likes to, you know, control what you're hearing and when, and only let dissenting voices appear later. So I think a lot of what you're getting now is people that might potentially have not so good coverage are throwing a lot of their big announcements out so people can stew over them and create buzz. And then when E3 hits and people start actually getting hands-on time, you know, if it's not as positive, you know, now you have a positive message and hype built up, which, you know, naturally in our line of work counteracts the serious work done by a lot of critics out there. So
what do you think? The PSP Go leak, intentional?
Not only intentional, but it was, you know, David Perry, of all people, leaked it, if you remember, a few months
back. Well, I'm talking about this weekend specifically. Like, the video came out on their core, their, like, digital video magazine thing.
I think...
And that was basically how it was confirmed. I mean, it's pretty official once you see it on their official.
When it was leaked on Core, it's pretty apparent that that is how Sony wanted to announce it, because they control when Core is released.
Yeah.
And there's no way that a pre E3 issue of Core was, you know, released on the wrong day. Of all issues to, you know, release at the wrong time, this would not be it.
Yeah.
So, you know, the PSP Go had been, it was kind of the biggest open secret in the industry for a while. So they knew that they needed to get some form of spin on it before their press conference, because when everybody knows about your widget, you know, you can't surprise people at your press conference, which is where you try and surprise people. Yeah. You know, if this was their big, huge announcement, people would yawn because, we heard about this from David Perry's Twitter 3 months ago, and, you know, 1UP broke a story about it a month ago. So they definitely did that intentionally. I don't think they are screwing up.
I actually think a lot of the trailers that they've been releasing is more of just a teaser initially, so that developers and press and everybody else kind of knows what to look for, knows what they want to get hands on with, or perhaps the developers have additional announcements to go with it. Like with the Marvel Ultimate Alliance one, it looks like they might be announcing the rest of the characters through E3. Because there's a list, I think there's like seven or eight slots still left in the roster for the game that haven't been filled yet. I mean, we've seen a couple of them in the video, like Green Goblin and Venom, but I'm wondering if the developers aren't trying to make people look their direction, and then they can say, hey, look at this. This is what we were actually going to announce. So I'm wondering if a lot of that might be what they're doing for this E3 anyway.
I hope so. I mean, I really hope they didn't blow their load already. There's no other way to put it. I mean, really, just there wouldn't be very much left to talk about. I mean, even with the Zune HD stuff that Microsoft announced earlier this week, it was kind of like, yeah, here it is, and we got something else to tell you about, but you're going to have to wait to E3. So, but even it kind of ruins the surprise. Like, for me, like last year when Microsoft did the Final Fantasy 13 announcement, like, that was like, it was amazing to be sitting in that audience, and like the realization like everybody had was like, holy shit, it's Final Fantasy 13 on Microsoft's platform. Like,
that was nobody, to this nobody day, that remains the greatest punch in the face to fanboys I have ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, it was just like, everyone was like, oh my god, and like, you could hear the laptop keyboards going crazy, like slamming, like everyone trying to get it out as fast as they could.
Yeah.
I hope we have that this year, because that's cool. I mean, it really is. I mean, let's face it, the whole back and forth war between all the console makers and stuff is part of the fun.
As dumb as it is, I do take particular glee in watching fanboys squirm over messages like this. Like, when Microsoft did the FF13 reveal, it was awesome to see all the PS3 hardcore fanboys like, well, you know, well, maybe it's coming out, but it won't have, you know, the power of Blu-ray, and they'll have to, you know, the graphics will suck, and you'll have to switch discs, and oh my god, it's going to be so bad. I can't believe that people are going to like this. I'm so glad I own a PS3. I love Sony. It's like, just seeing people flip their shit over that is amazing, and it's the best reason to be on the internet, is watch irrational people defend their irrational views.
Yeah. All right, well, I'm looking forward to it. I'm disappointed I can't be there this year, but...
You and me both.
We still have PAX. Year. PAX is coming up.
We do. PAX will be good, and hopefully next year we can have a couple people going to E3 to cover it. So, we're running out of time, though, so let's wrap things up.
Yeah, you gotta watch the Red Wings.
I do. There's that, too. That's 2 minutes from now, so let's keep going. There's only one co-op release coming in the next 2 weeks that we know of, unless there's some surprise Xbox Live Arcade or PSN announcement.
That's a hell of a release.
But it's a good one, yeah. Gunstar Heroes for Xbox Live Arcade and PlayStation Network, June 10th on Xbox Live Arcade and June 11th on the PlayStation Network. So that's the classic Sega Genesis game. I will be purchasing that.
And you might as well bring up that this has already been released on Virtual Console, so if you, for some reason you own a Wii and you don't own this, don't be a fool.
Yeah, it adds online. This one adds online co-op, though, so that's good stuff right there.
Right.
For the site, though, we've been pretty busy this month. Had quite a few reviews. We reviewed Terminator Salvation, Raiden Fighters Aces, Sacred 2 Fallen Angel for 360 and PlayStation 3, Zombie Wranglers. We had our Beyond co-op reviews, where we reviewed Wolverine, Riddick, Dark Athena, Lux Payne. I'm not going to say the entire title, but Devil Summoner 2, GTA Chinatown Wars, and Defense Grid. we also had a few features out there. One, it's not really a feature, but it's one you should look for. If you're playing Sacred 2 for the console, a lot of the community members came up with a huge list of tips for the game. And we kind of posted that on our front page. So give that a look. We also had a great co-op editorial from Jim on Western co-op games and the lack thereof.
Western-themed,
I should say. Yeah, actually, Jim had a problem when he was writing that. He's like, I'm not exactly sure how to word this because I don't want it to mean, like, Western-developed.
Yeah.
So, yes, Western-themed co-op games. And then Mark finished up his DLC versus disc editorial for the music games. That we had a Battlefield report for Hawks. And we all kind of came up with some E3 predictions. So we'll see how we do there this coming week. If you're listening to us on iTunes, we recommend you leave feedback. Give us a little review. Let us know how we're doing. I think we're up to 10 now. Awesome. I think that's almost like the big leagues. Right?
Double digits.
No.
Sure.
Not even close, huh? Okay. Follow us on Twitter. We are Co-Optimus on Twitter without the dash. Give us a follow. We do giveaways on there. I've been really trying to actively like communicate with people back and forth more now. We have that Twitter feed in our admin section, and if I see people asking us stuff or whatever, I've been trying to reply. It looks like we might have a couple extra Dawn of War 2 prizes, and I think I'm going to give them away over Twitter. So if you want to sign up, I'll do that sometime this week maybe. I think that's about it. So I thank both of you for joining me. Mike, hopefully there's nothing wrong with your head.
Hopefully.
Kat, I already know there's something wrong with your head.
That magnetic field.
Yeah.
What was it's it, first plate. Line of defense against the cyborgs?
Yep.
Skynet, yep. That's right.
When Skynet launches, we're just handing them Kat and it's all
no,
over.
No, we're not gonna hand them Kat. We're going to throw Kat at them.
We're going to launch her in a catapult.
Yes. Like the diseases, yeah. Great.
Yeah, see, our modern-day plague bearer.
All right, so this has been the Co-Opticast for Co-Optimus.com. Thanks for listening. We out.